Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Continuing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. There's a historian of religion who wrote a book about commercialism in religion. And he has a line in that book that has always struck me and stayed with me, which is that he was sort of that he followed religion the way that other people follow sports, meaning not just that it was sort of this collective struggle that had a game-like quality, but that he was a fan. And it's a strange thing, sort of being a fan as opposed to a believer of religions. But it's an attitude that I've always had as a way of sort of balancing or moving between the two positions of faith and let's call it, you know, secular skepticism, where even though I mostly fall on the latter side of things in terms of my beliefs about what we can know and what we should claim and how far we should allow our beliefs to go, at the same time, I remain deeply moved, entranced, amused, entertained, fascinated, and sometimes transformed by the spectacles, texts, individuals, and struggles within religion. And I mean religion with a capital R. I mean, no, now we're not talking spirituality, psycho-spirituality, self-help, New Age. I'm talking capital R religion, Catholics, Mennonites, Shi'i, etc., etc. And I discovered for this week's guest a fellow traveler in the world's not only of religious fandom, being a fan of all sorts of strange expressions of religious dreams and desires and beliefs, but also a particular fan of a particular team, that is Team Mormon. So today we'll be talking with Thomas Metzger. We've had him on the show before. He's a writer living in upstate New York, and his new book is called Undercover Mormon, and it is the first of his many books that is a personal story, and it's about his own sort of the dip into Mormon reality as he basically goes undercover to his local, I think they call them stakes, and sort of acts like a potential convert, and meanwhile describes his own explorations, conversations, local history expeditions, and really just a wonderful dive into the weirdness and sort of charming banality of the LDS Church. So I'm really happy to be talking with him about this super, super fun book and a kind of attitude towards religion that I wish more people had. it's a fun one. But before we bring Tom on, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
So of all the like big religions, you know, the capital R religions, what would you say you're the biggest fan of?
Man, first of all, Team Mormon, that was really funny, dude. But yeah, it is. It's like teams, you know? And I am a full-on religious spectator as well. I remember even as, like, early on, I saw a Sufi whirling dervish performance, and I watched it. And I mean, my mind was blown away, like, watching these guys. And like you know, you see some of these teams performing, and it doesn't really matter what team they're on. If they really get into some of these things, just are no other way to explain it, expressions of the human soul. No matter how weird, it's like they all have bands, right? And, you know, your band may be a little quirky, like maybe like Gore, but even Gore could be that perfect expression of some aspect of the human soul. I mean, I think it's the same way with teens. And if I was to pick a team, I don't know, because, I mean, it's like music. It's like saying, what's your favorite music genre?
That is true. It's like, it's sort of an unfair question.
Yeah, but I do. I'm with you, man. I'm a fan.
Yeah, I was really happy in our I live in an apartment building, and the owner of the building is a he's actually an Orthodox Jew, although his manner is much more of a kind of a groovy Bay Area Reform Jew. But he goes to an Orthodox synagogue, and there was an apartment opening, and he rented it to this Orthodox family, Chabad family, and there's not a lot of, you know, visibly Orthodox Jews in San Francisco, and
right.
They're full on. You know, they have every Shabbat, they're partying, they're dancing, there's people coming by. I'm kind of glad that they don't live immediately above us, because they're a noisy crew, and there's
like
many
kids.
It's
a noisy dance.
And,
yeah, it's like
and
a heavy
more
metal
on the
band
way, but there, I feel a sort of, I'll say a blessing having that energy in the apartment, and I'm very happy about this sort of, you know, this world which is not mine and is not supposed to be mine, and yet there's some kind of life to the building that I have, even if I understand there are problems with it. Orthodox this, and, you know, he won't shake my wife's hand, and,
right.
You know, I don't want to talk about Israel with him, and, you know, there's all this stuff, and yet I prefer to kind of enjoy and embrace the sort of, the blessing of the proximity of these kinds of amazing human creations, these religions with rituals and myths and you know, songs and concepts. It's a remarkable thing.
Yes.
Okay, with that, let's bring on Tom to the show. Tom, welcome back to Expanding Mind.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, this is really, man. What a kid. I just had such a blast reading your book. It was so fun, and you hit all the right notes on the stuff I knew about Mormonism. I mean, like you, I've been kind of I've dug deep, and I could even hear myself in some of your, you know, the ways you were reacting to ideas or to people, you and me. I mean, I've had the same experience of you know, meeting missionaries, you know, younger people in the church, and starting to like probe them on the esoterica, like, well, what can you tell me about Kolob? And then seeing the blank look on their faces and realizing that this church that looks like on the outside like ordinary Christians has within it all of this magic and esoteric and strange Freemasonry and all these sorts of histories. So it totally makes sense to me that you were obsessed with this, especially coming from New York, but nonetheless, it is still a crazy thing to begin to make the moves of a potential convert week after week. So you got to tell me what kind of led you to really push this experiment into reality.
Well, I'd been dancing around. Well, because I live about a half an hour from the high holy sites, even since I was a kid, the waves of Mormonic energy, you know, kind of waft over the area where I live. So it's always sort of in the air here. But over the years, I was digging deeper and deeper in standard research, a book and scholarly research. And it is not actually clear. One of the chapters in the book is Antidepressants Made Me a Mormon, and and my psychiatrist read the book recently, and he was quite amused it's a stretch, because it only been 2 days on a very, very low dose of citalopram, so it's basically a shtick to start the dance or the incursion. But it was a strange blizzardy day. I showed up in church, and when I was asked by the young ladies who became my guides into their world, they said, "So what brings you here today?" And I could say honestly, I'm really not sure. But I felt drawn. I felt called to do it today. And they figured if it was a blizzard day, hard even to get through the streets, then I must have been called by a higher power than just strange curiosity. So it is a little bit mysterious why then. It's been about a year, year and a half since I started the project. The book came out pretty recently. So oddly enough, at this point, I'm still a bit mystified why that day, although I could talk forever about why that group, as you've mentioned.
Well, one place we could just start out is maybe talk a little bit about where you live and what makes that area so charged with Mormonic energy.
Yeah. Rochester is a small city on Lake Ontario, and about a half an hour to the east of here is the sacred hill, the Hill Cumorah, which is a really small hill. It sounds more impressive than it is. There's a strange geological phenomenon called the Wayne County Swarm, which is there are hundreds of these little hills called drumlins. They're a glacial phenomenon. But anyway, the Hill Cumorah is one of the hundreds of drumlins in that area. And so the Joseph Smith family ended up there from Vermont. And so the Mormon Church has been buying up all the important properties in Wayne County, which is the county next to where I live. Absolutely anything related to Mormon history, Mormon money is now going in and buying up, and they take really nice care of their property. So I'm actually happy that they're buying up forest land and land to keeping it out of the hands of developers. So in any case, the shadow looms over the region, and the more I dug into the esoteric end is probably the real trigger. The deeper I got into particularly the wizardry and the esoteric practices, the more I got into that, the more I knew I had to really get my butt into the pew and experience it firsthand. Oddly, I was hoping for a lot, in a way, I was hoping for a lot more sparks and fire, but I eventually found it. I didn't find it really in the weekly church services, but I did eventually find some pretty serious religious mania, and I agree with your early statement about being a fan. It's funny coming from this region. The Buffalo Bills are in this region, and Buffalo Bills fans are very sad people. The team never wins, and I don't share at all their interest. But the idea of the fan shed, that a certain team extends how many hundred miles from Buffalo or Chicago or Cleveland or whatever. So the fan shed here of the Hill Cumorah reaches well past my house. So.
I wonder. Well, there's so many things to pick up there. And one point I also wanted to bring in about the book, just to alert people, is that one of the things that I really appreciate about it, and again, it's partly because it strikes so close to home, is that every time you're going to the Sunday service, you tell us what song you listen to on the radio and
right.
or on your tape deck, and it's this great curated collection of weird Americana and a lot of early 70s heavy metal and glam rock and sort of science fiction oriented music like Hawkwind and things like that. All music that's all very important to me and has really shaped my imagination, and I think partly shaped the imagination that has made me interested in religion. So in that sense, I think there's a similarity in that the music that I listened to, the culture that I identified with when I was a young man and then, through my 20s and still to today, gave me a certain taste for the cosmic, for the science fictional, for sword and sorcery, for this kind of brawny imagination that really is not so different than a lot of religion. And then you draw that connection very well.
Yeah, I figured it out when I was working on the book that The first time I went to the Hill Cumorah pageant, which is the big multi-thousands of folks come from all over the country to this pageant, 800 people on the hill reenacting the story of the Book of Mormon. I went out there as a teenager. My family went out there, and I figured it out. It was about a month after David Bowie came to Rochester on the first date of his Diamond Dogs tour. And I think back-to-back, the Hill Cumorah pageant and seeing Bowie for the first time in 74, I believe, was a great combination. Yeah, so pop music and particularly strange SF music, science fiction-y music, definitely worked well as a way of getting into and out of the persona. I had taped the entirety of Diamond Dogs, and I played it the first night I went out to the pageant, and it worked absolutely perfectly. It started as I got in the car, and it ended as I pulled into the parking lot, ready to go. So I used that as a, in a way, as a way for myself to make the transition. I went under a false name. I changed my name to Anton Mesmer, which absolutely no one ever asked me about Anton Mesmer.
Wow.
And I did that because I thought if I slipped and I said Tom Metzger, or if I said Tom, I could say, well, I mean Mesmer. I could kind of do a fake stumble. And I told him, I'm Anton, but you can call me Tom. And what was really wonderful is as I dug deeper, and in this case literally dug, because I got out, I found the grave of one of the wizards, literal wizards, who trained Joseph Smith in some of his esoteric practices, a guy named Lumen Walter. And it took me a long time, but I did find the grave. And the more I dug on him, he had actually studied with Anton Mesmer in Europe. So
what?
They had this wonderful link. It's apostolic succession. Anton Mesmer to Lumen Walter to Joseph Smith. There is a direct. Yeah, so that kind of thing made the story, well, made the process really fun for me.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that early part. I mean, just that, you know, again, people who know Mormonism casually, or even many Mormons, don't really grok the extremely bizarre world of folk magic that was a very, very vital part of early in the United States, particularly in your area, particularly in the early 19th century. And it's sort of a blank, fuzzy spot. Even if you read detailed histories of 19th century America, this will often be completely and utterly ignored. And yet it was a vast, extremely rich, important part of ordinary people's lives. So capture that a little bit for us.
Well, certainly the Smith family, when they came from Vermont, they already brought with them some of their folk magic practices, amulets, various objects that would have power. And there was what some people call a money-digging economy. There were dozens of money diggers who would travel around, mostly New England, New York State, and Pennsylvania, and they'd come to your town, in effect, and say, I'm a magic money digger. Give me X amount of dollars, and we'll figure out, we'll do a magic ritual out in your field, or I have a sense that there's money in your property. And so the Smith family is just one of many people who participated in this money digging economy. And that's the reason that he ended up in trouble with the law the first time, that he was considered a disorderly person. That was the charge that was levied against him for practicing magic, in effect. And Lumen Walter, too, his mentor, the wizard, he actually did time in jail in Vermont as a wizard. We're talking about about 1810, 1820, 30. This is not dark ages that people were being wizards and going to jail for being wizards. So it is a very homey kind of magic, too, which is part of the reasons I find it charming and appealing. It's farmers. It is natural, in some ways natural magic. There's not a lot of complex connections to European magic. There's some, but it's not as though it's a continuous, complex tradition. But in any case, the Smith family were deeply into this, and Joseph Smith had the brains or the chutzpah, whatever you want to call it, to transform that into religion, for which I admire him greatly. He's a transformer. And took something fairly small and modest and made it something large and white and glowing.
Well, you know, that's a funny thing about,
sure,
about Joseph Smith. And I remember reading, I think the first time I started to, like, really get fascinated was reading Harold Bloom's book on the American religion, which historians of American religion routinely condemn because it's sort of not his territory, but I still find it to be insightful in ways that most of those other texts aren't. And one of the things that he says in it, because he's a literary critic, he's someone who's coming from to this notion of literature and of producing imaginative literature,
mm-hmm,
and he's just like, basically, like, whatever else you say about Joseph Smith is that he was a genius, and he was this kind of, you know, this remarkable, remarkably creative and purposeful person. And so for me, Joseph Smith is kind of a litmus test for how people think about religion, because Mormonism, especially the more you know about the details and the particular cosmology and the weird ideas, the more bizarre and counterintuitive it is, if you're not already signed up. And then we have the whole spectacle of the modern sort of conservative, button-down CIA, FBI, Mormon church. And so if you can, with all that, still look at this guy and go, he was a remarkable man. You know, like, I would have loved to have seen him or met him. I mean, there's this kind of fondness, amazement, over-the-top kind of quality that I find very appealing, but I think a lot of people would go, this guy's a huckster, it's sham, it's the worst aspect of religion, it's manipulative, da-da-da-da. And but that doesn't happen to me, and it clearly doesn't happen to you. So
no.
How do you, after all the study and thinking about it and being around, being in this area, you know, reading his histories, reading his words, what is your feeling about Joseph Smith? What was he like?
The main appeal. Well, I agree with the idea that with what you just said, that there's a certain genius. He was not a genius when it came to putting words next to each other in a row in an interesting manner. Mark Twain referred to Book of Mormon as chloroform in print, and I've yet to meet a person who said I've read the entirety of the book. It's tough going, but that being said, he was a hillbilly hoodoo man, and it's real country, and it's really American, which is one of the reasons I find it very appealing. And I think Bloom found that attractive too. He said, he's our man. He's the equivalent of, he's Huck Finn, he's Daniel Boone, he's those kind of guys. Bigger than life, way off of the scale when it comes to in narcissism, and yet very much rooted in ordinary, in some ways, ordinary American, in this case, farm culture, rural culture. So I find the early Joe Smith far more appealing than I find the later Joe Smith, later meaning what the church itself has done to make him, gussy him up, basically, even down to the fact that the early pictures of him, he basically had no chin. He was not a very handsome man, but the current paintings of him, he's very good looking. So there's been this transformation from this kind of dirty, down home hillbilly hoodoo man to a very, very glamorized and not as interesting person as he used to be. So one of my
do you think about that? Like, in your experience of seeing or having that reveal, that sort of emperor has no clothes type of thing, how do you feel like that translates in other religions? I mean, here you have this opportunity to see the real Messiah, and you know,
right,
get it, like, you know, like Eric said, like, I like reading about the people, you know, and then
right,
it's like what the religion does to them. What do you feel like the difference, you know, you said you like the early guy, but what do you think, that's just what religions do to these like exceptional people that then they kind of turn into messiahs, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I know what you're describing, and I think that you're right that it extends beyond just beyond Mormonism. There seems to be an impulse to want to, obviously, to clean up these people, but it also, in some ways, sucks the energy out of them, which I find kind of sad.
Yeah.
And it's certainly common. I mean, even going back to Jesus, there's lots and lots of, you know, people arguing about, you know, who was the real Jesus, and it's been going on for 100 and whatever years. But the early, it seems like typically there's a lot of energy and, I've been thinking of using the word hero in the kind of early sense of the Achilles hero, as in beyond, in a way, beyond good and evil, beyond good and bad, bigger than life, bigger than the rest of us, because they're touched by God, at least, or they have a sense that they're touched by God. It's a very common process, and I'm. And then are you thinking around the world that you see this too, not just in?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can, and even more recently, right? You can look at like L. Ron Hubbard.
Sure,
he's
a good example.
That's another good example. But even around cultures, right? Like there'll be certain individuals that are raised to kind of a higher status, and everyone's like, follow them, and then it just kind of like snowballs. Like you could see Moses as well. Another good example.
It does seem that if you're going to start a religion, don't do it at a time when there are newspapers, because because somebody 100 years later will dig out the newspapers and read them. So
right.
Moses the prophets of his era, it's so blurry. But Joe Smith, you know, I can look at the newspapers, and you know, L. Ron Hubbard, it's not just newspapers. We can talk to people who knew him still. So it is curious that what mass media and access to solid sources like newspapers and even photographs, that really has changed the notion of what a savior, messiah, prophet, etc. is. And Joe Smith had there are no photos of him that are known, but there are plenty of paintings, and so even that, the paintings themselves slowly transmute him into something that a photo would always keep him fixed as he looked and when the photo was snapped. So yeah, I hadn't really thought quite in those terms that it's a common or global phenomenon, but of course you're right. And I guess the impulse is to want our saviors, messiahs, and prophets to be not quite human. And Joe Smith was a very human guy. He bragged about he loved to wrestle. He was fairly hard drinking early on. He's a very, very human man. And that's embarrassing, I think, probably for the current church, but inarguable. One of my favorite images of him is very near the end of his life when he ran for president. There's a painting of him dressed in full Napoleonic uniform with the epaulets, the sword, the big hat with the feathers, etc. So sadly, I think what happened to him is he started to buy his own hype. Early on, he's charming. By the end, he's bought into the hype, like a rock star, I think. If you have somebody chanting your name, and I just think about any teenager who becomes a rock star, you know, early Led Zeppelin or whatever, what must have happened to those guys like Robert Plant when he walked out on the stage and there's 10,000 people shrieking his name, and, you know, his brain wasn't even fully formed. He wasn't even 27 yet. Same thing with a prophet. I think a Joe Smith would have all these people believing, if you want to use that word, in what he's saying and shouting his name, etc. I can't help but think that it changes the way a person thinks about himself. So I think that's part of the phenomenon.
Well, this is great. I have so many more questions to ask, but we're going to take a break right now.
Sure.
You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Maja Daou. We're talking with Tom Metzger about being an undercover Mormon.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with co-host Eric Davis. And today we're speaking with Tom Metzger, and we're talking about Mormonism and how Tom decided to go undercover into the religion and do a little snooping around. And a little while ago, you had mentioned about some of the crazy synchronicities that happened to you over the course of your journey through Mormonism. And I was wondering, you mentioned too about how you just live next to the holy sites. Do you feel, or did you, I mean, as you're still going through it or through the process, do you feel like you were spiritually connected to Mormonism somehow? Or did you ever feel like when you went to the holy sites, did you feel anything? Like, did it elicit anything sincere in you as you went through this process of, like, in terms of connecting to the religion? Or did you feel like you were always an observer?
The whole process, in one way, may had a major transformation on me, and I'm going around in the sort of a corner, but to answer the question. And the more I thought about it, the more I showed up at church and in the holy sites, the less I thought belief mattered. That I could talk to someone and say, I don't think that the words coming out of their mouth are true words, but the practice seemed to always trump the vocabulary, and the practice itself seemed to trump the beliefs. And so by the end of the process, I've gotten to the point where I'm not convinced anymore that the word belief is even that useful in talking about religion, because Mormonism, at least in my case, was so much about doing versus thinking it's true or not true, or accepting doctrine or not accepting doctrine. So that's a long way around to say that when I was in some of the services, when I was been out at the sacred sites, there is power there, and I don't use the word believe or disbelieve, but clearly there seems to be extraordinary experiences. And I don't say, do I believe that this is true or that is true, but do I say my experience was different? Absolutely.
That's such a good way to put it, because, you know, so many, say, anti-religious folks, like atheists or, you know, skeptics, that's their always, they come up with this, well, how could you believe? And they always attack the beliefs. But
right.
I very much agree with you. Like, religion is something you can do. Like, it's a practice. Like, you actually do stuff. So I think people come into that problem when they start just philosophizing and debating it. But like you, I think a lot of these issues could be solved if people just, like, sat down and did their, you know, whatever the practice is and continued
right.
it. But so would you say, in your opinion, that you found the practices to be, like, a viable spiritual methodology?
Interesting. Eventually, I did say goodbye to them.
Right.
At no point did I ever think I was going to become part of the church. But did I see people experiencing the divine in their own way? On occasion, I think I absolutely did. And particularly the people, interestingly, I think the people who were more outliers than the people who were born and bred Mormons. I think the folks, and this is probably true of most organized religions, if people who grow up in a church or grow up in a religion and they take it in with their mother's milk from birth, they seem to have a different relationship to the practices, whereas the people who come from other traditions and embrace them, that's where I think I saw, at least, people having more intense, genuine spiritual experiences than the folks who just, this is what I always heard was the case, and so this is what I do. Sort of like this, we always drive on the right side of the road in America, and then I was driving on the left side for a while, and I had to ask, okay, why am I, you know, this is our cultural practice, now we have a new cultural practice. I better really want to drive on the left side of the road if I'm going to do that. So similarly with Mormon practices, I met a woman who was probably my favorite person I encountered, and she was a biker. She started off as a biker. She came from a very tough background. She was a spiritualist and that's another piece of the geography here. Spiritualism, as we know it, started in Rochester, the Fox Sisters' cabin, where modern spiritualism, as we know it, is about.
He was inspired by Anton Mesmer, and Mesmerism.
There you go. And it's about 5 minutes from the Hill Cumorah. So this is, you know, talking to the dead central here, or at least it has been over the years. My point, though, being that it didn't really matter to me that when this woman would tell me about her spiritual practices or spiritualism, I didn't really care whether it was true or false, but it was really fascinating to sit with her on the top of the hill, Cumorah, watching the sunset, and listening to Led Zeppelin, listening to "Stairway to Heaven," "God Save Us," of all songs, and watching the sun go down in something in the west. It was really kind of a remarkable experience, and she was my favorite person. And other people have said they like her as a character in the book. And obviously, I had to change names and fuzz up some of the details, but she was the real thing, and I really enjoyed talking to her probably the most.
Well, I can't help but it's sort of an obvious question, but one of the interesting things about the book for me was you wrestling with why you were doing this. With, is this cheesy? Am I being an asshole? Why am I doing this? And then developing some authentic relationships. And are these people going to be hurt later? Are they? And then, you know, you're talking about your interest in paganism and, you know, all the sort of beautiful praises to the sexy Mormon girls and some of the Mormon imagery and some of the posters and all this kind of stuff. And you're like, you know what the kind of thing you're going to write, and that this is going to come out and is going to trouble, hurt, confuse, enervate these people that you were dealing with. And yet, in a way, there's something very kind of sweet and tender about what you're doing. I don't get the sense of someone who's moving in there with a capital P prankster's sardonic edge. You know, there was certainly,
right,
you know, like in the 70s here in San Francisco, the Cacophony Society, they'd do things like infiltrate the Moonies or whatever, but they did it just completely out of this like radical, you know, avant-garde edge, and you don't have that. You want to make connections. You want to find out what people's going on. You want to get a sense of people's souls. So I'm curious now that it's over and the book is out there and the whole thing, the jig is up, as they say.
Yeah.
How does your heart process all of these complex questions of being with other people and representing yourself to other people, particularly in a religious context?
Big part of the project was asking myself, so what exactly are you doing? And I did not want to do a hatchet job, and I'm grateful, I'm thankful that nobody that I know that's read it or reviewed it has said this is just another guy making fun of people for being different. I didn't want to do that, and I think that I succeeded in not just going in and mocking or being disruptive. The process, but I was lying early. I was lying from the beginning, and it's a curious phenomenon. I learned a lot about lying. I learned some good lying techniques. I got a good article out of it called "Lying My Way to Heaven" about its effect on my marriage. My wife said that the only thing that she was concerned about the process is that I was getting better at lying because I was learning how to do it, and I'm a pretty honest guy. When it was all over and I said goodbye, I got a very, very long, detailed, heartfelt email from one of the young women who I'd spent the most time with learning about the church. And she said in her email, basically begging me to please reconsider and come back and get baptized, she said, "Of all my 18 months in my mission in Western New York, I learned the most about Mormonism from you." And I thought, it was kind of moving, and I didn't want to write back and say, "Well, sorry, I didn't say a whole lot because I wasn't sure how to respond to it. I didn't want to just be one more jackass, you know, making fun of people. And at the same time, some of it truly is absurd and hilarious. And how do you describe absurd and hilarious with some affection?" And I'm hoping I did some of that in the book. I think that some of that comes through.
Yeah, I think it does, and that's partly what really intrigues me, is that it's a very subtle, complicated, but also sort of not naive, but there's a kind of simplicity about being in the middle of all of these potential attitudes towards religion and sort of being okay there and even being able to communicate with people there. I mean, that's something I often flash on, is because I'm so interested in other people's religious worldviews, and that I feel like, you know, when I'm reading a religious text, it's like I'll let it take me the way that I will if I'm reading a science fiction book. Like, I'm just going to go in there. And then when I meet people who embody it, the difference between a religious believer who's going through a ritual and a true fan who is, like, obsessively kind of inhabiting their science fiction universe, like a Trekker or something like that, like, it's obviously different, but they're sort of iterations of something that's kind of recognizable.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you kind of move through that space and you know, talking to people who are coming from a very specifically religious background, in situations where they don't really know where I'm coming from, I'm much more likely to sort of never lie the way that, not that you had lies about your name and your identity, but you also did a really interesting thing of not lying about the beliefs. Like, when they said, so do you believe that the Book of Mormon is true, you were like, you found very subtle ways to use scripture and speak the truth about your own more experimental approach to it, but yet you were also kind of allowing that connection to happen in an authentic way. And it's just a very tricky game, but a beautiful one. And I thought you described it very well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I chose early on that I would never say that I thought anything was true or not true. I stuck with that the entire way through. I never once lied and said, yes, I now think this is true, and I never pushed back and said, that's wrong. I sometimes would say things like, you could imagine that other people might find this a bit troubling, or can you help me with my confusion? You know, words to that effect. But oddly, I used and it shows up in the book, my sister-in-law was dying during this process, so I truly was dealing with the grief of the death of someone close to me. And I was completely upfront about that with the people that I spoke with there. And I said, I'm facing the death of a person dear to me. Basically, what do you got? What can you offer me? And that was completely true. Different name, but I described the process of going through the death of someone I was close to. And the Mormons are very interested in what do you do with death. They have lots to say about it, some of which is more, well, most of which does not comfort me, but they're very much willing to talk about it and to face it. Whereas I think a lot of religions, you know, they have a story that they'll tell you about death, but they usually don't do much with it. And I was impressed that they were able to, you know, at least meet me halfway and talk to me about grief, talk to me about death.
Well, that's pretty interesting, and there's this fascinating thing culturally or psychologically with what you did, and that it could technically be a test for any religion, right? If any religion is saying, like, hey, y'all, we got the answers, like, this is the deal, you should be able to have some significant crisis or just physical existence, you know, thing, and just step into any one of those religions that claims it. And if you do their things, if what they say is true, right, it should be helpful. It should make some difference. They're like, you should be, you know, saved or see the light or whatever. So,
right.
But that's, like, the true test is, like, how practical is the religion, right? Can you go into a system, like you said, not born into it, but just, you know, stick anybody anywhere, and will it still go?
Right. Yeah. And I also noticed that Mormons, more than just about any religious group that I've ever met, were comfortable with saying the phrase, I don't know. And I give them credit for that. When you'd say, this really doesn't make sense, or, you know, help me understand about the multiple planets and where God lives, etc., or take something that most Americans would say, it just doesn't make sense. If you ask them in a fairly straightforward manner, explain this to me, they seem pretty comfortable saying, I really don't know, and not saying, well, you just have to accept it, or it's a mystery, or go away. Basically, I don't know, and you don't know, and maybe we'll find out someday, but right now, don't know. And I give them credit for that.
I'm interested that I'm curious, actually, whether part of the tug towards getting baptized, because there's a part where you're like, you know, you're in the process, you know, everybody knows what's happening here, you're getting closer to this thing, right. You start to talk about it, and then you're sharing your qualms with the reader and your friends, but you know, there's clearly a draw, and I'm curious whether part of the draw, you know, you explain it, is partly just to, you know, go through with the project, to, you know, just curiosity, there's a lot of reasons, but I'm curious if part of it was because the idea that once you get the baptism, you get a temple recommend, and you are actually able to go into the temple, which, just for listeners, it's not like a church in that you have to be a Mormon to get in. And not only do you have to be a Mormon, you have to have basically a ticket to get in that's given to you because you've been a good Mormon. So the temple is someplace very secret and sacred in a way that most modern religions have let go of. If they've ever even had it. And so that's a very peculiar part of Mormonism that I think gives it some of its charge and some of its weirdness and some of, you know, even its kind of creepy control things, because this enables the church to control people's behavior more closely than in other situations. But I'm curious whether part of your draw was like, man, I'd really like to go inside that temple.
Of course, that was the case. When the temple was opened here maybe 10, 15 years ago, the church invited religious leaders from every stripe in the area, come visit the temple. You can come in and see it all before it's consecrated. And they were very upfront. Everybody can take a look. Once it's consecrated, you'll no longer be welcome. And so I did not go. I was not invited, because I'm not a religious leader. But I knew people who did, and it was basically a tour, and you got to see everything within there. And so it was really just, yes, there's a secretive element to it, but also yes, they're fairly upfront about saying exactly what everything is there, photographs, but the point is, it's sacred space. And at least in their understanding, sacred space without a ticket, to use your term, is a no-go. So I definitely wanted to get in, but there was another factor in the baptism equation. I was baptized a Roman Catholic as an infant, and recently I found out that the priest who did it, I was baptized by a priest wearing complete vestments made out of a German parachute that was captured at D-Day. So I love the image of myself as a squalling baby being baptized by a priest in full vestments made of German silk. So I was baptized an infant, and then many years later I became a Mennonite, and Mennonites are Anabaptists, which means literally rebaptizer. So I was rebaptized, and I thought, oh, I really wanted the triple crown, and I wanted to get a third one, and so it would have made a fun element in the book, but it also would have been a snarky kind of, I don't know, less than noble element in the book. So I didn't get my triple crown. I got pneumonia instead. I got pneumonia and lost a couple weeks, and that for me was the turning point in the story where I started to pull away. So.
And then I'm kind of curious, like, because you've been a sort of traveler with religion for mm-hmm. quite a long time, whatever you want to call it, dabbling, more than dabbling, trying out all sorts of practices. I mean, there's a lot of references in the book to your own interest in
right.
both traditional kind of hoodoo folk magic and also your own improvised folk magic, taking bones and small figurines with you when you go to the Mormon church as a kind of sacred thing, and digging for grave dirt, gopher dust, etc. So you're obviously you're very comfortable and you enjoy this world of practice. And my question to you is also in some ways a question to me and to other people like this, that is your interest in exploring these practices and in having the experiences that come with them ultimately just kind of aesthetic, or, hey, let's just make this, you know, difficult passage through the world a little bit more rich and entertaining?
Right.
Or is there a kind of deeper, you could call it philosophical, you could call it theological, you could call it existential search that's pushing through that, even as you recognize the humor and there's the charm and then there's the history and all the kind of other ways of being with this material, but is there something also that's pushing you that has a real quest to it?
I think so. I don't think any of these are mutually exclusive. I think there is an aesthetic component for sure, and that can be layered on top of the quest, which can be layered on top of many other, some of the other things you just mentioned. So is it a deeper, for me at least, is it a deeper quest for truth? The answer is no. Is it a deeper quest for experience? The answer is yes. And I'm more and more convinced that experience trumps truth. So when something is beautiful, as religion often can be, and when it is powerful, and when it reaches a sub-rational level, and that's when I know I'm in the groove. And I think the phrase sub, or the word sub-rational, at least for me, is useful. That if I feel like it's reaching me below the level of standard reason, and I don't mean in a sort of absurd berserker manner, but reaching me in a way that seems like it's talking to heart rather than head, or even talking to spine rather than heart, then it seems like that it's, for me, it's much more of a authentic experience. Although authentic, even that, what does that mean anymore when everything is in a postmodern world where everything is available and everything is sort of blurs into each other?
That's a great response. I mean, I think I'm partly still just riffing off of something earlier that Maja said about how skeptics and atheists are all about belief and holding these cognitive positions that that don't pass muster, and therefore the whole thing is bankrupt. And it's such a weird, it's worth talking about, because while for me that whole position is kind of absurd, it's so powerful. It has so much cultural cachet, especially now. And what's odd about it, ironic about it, is that it's also kind of, it's very Christian. Because the whole idea of judging a religion, or even the word religion, it comes out of Christianity. It comes out of particularly the Protestant Reformation and the notion that it was really in the heart of the individual believer, that in that place, particularly about belief positions, particularly about what doctrine you held and what doctrine you did not hold, that the real action was. So in a way, it's a very peculiar thing in the history of religion that Protestantism ended up getting so absorbed with belief and the conceptual quality of belief.
Yeah.
And then we carry that forward, and now we get it mirrored back to us from the atheists, where it's all about belief and the sort of conceptual position, when for thousands of years, everybody has mostly been doing something incredibly different than that, and we miss it all. So I think it's a wonderful thing to also encourage people to feel more comfortable around religion, which is that, you know, you have your own, we all have our own religion. And my example for this is that, like, you know, a lot of people have a lot of trouble with Jesus Christ. You know, they don't want to hear about it. It pisses them off. You know, they're ready to leave the table. And on the other hand, you have all these people who are very invested in Jesus Christ, and a particular Jesus Christ. This guy's Jesus Christ is very muscular. This one is very sweet and forgiving. This one is wielding a sword to slaughter all of the unbelievers, blah, blah, blah. And so my attitude, and I think it's the kind of Tom Metzger attitude, and then I'll shut up, is just like, well, you know, I got to have a Jesus. We all have Jesuses, right? I mean, you got one in your imagination. So I'm going to get a cool Jesus that I like. So I have a surfer, hippie, Jesus freak Jesus, and he's mellow and kind of enigmatic and a bit surly, and that's just my Jesus, and I'm okay with that.
It's odd. Since the Mormon Project, I've started, and I don't think it'll probably end up being a book, but I've been asking people who identify themselves as Christians and set them down in a safe place where they know they're not going to be made fun of, and I say, tell me who's your Jesus. And it's been really moving and remarkable how many Christians, self-identified Christians, when you put them in a safe spot and you say, just tell me about who's your Jesus, all of it seems like most of the BS falls away. And it's I've been rather moved by what they've had to say. And so I wonder how much of the so-called beliefs is really just a social posture that we've got to say certain words and we've got to, you know, wave certain flags when we're in a social context. But when we're alone with one guy who seems to be listening, well, you know, we can put away a lot of our BS and a lot of our nastiness. That has been my experience in the last few months, but
That's a great project. I mean, it's also that comes through in your book as well, in that some of the conversations you have with people are clearly sort of, you know, under the official line, but they're much more personal. And so, you know, you make discoveries that way, like discovering that at least some Mormons hold that the spirits of the departed are not in some, you know, faraway astral plane, that they're actually in our world, and that some people have the capacity to see them, that there is a visionary dimension that people acknowledge. But the way you find that out is kind of just by having these conversations. So it's hard because you kind of have to go, if not undercover, then at least really do the work of showing that you're creating a safe space where you're not coming from mockery in order to be able to make this kind of connection. And I think it's really important work, even if it's, you know, just, you know, one's personal investigation. It seems like a very important thing to do right now because there's so much anger and struggle over religion.
And one of the moving moments for me is when it's the phenomenon you just described about when the young women told me that actually it's fairly standard. Understanding the spirits of the dead are right here, and both of the young women told me that they had contact with these ancestors right here in this world. And I had brought along with me a 100-year-old beat-up old hymnal, and I showed him, and I said, "This is my grandfather's hymnal, and this is his favorite hymn." And I handed it to them. And one of the things I discovered is when you do that, nobody argues with grandpa's beat-up old hymnal because it's such a charming image, so I showed them this, and I said, "This is my grandfather's favorite hymn." And then they told me about spirits.
Speaking of spirits, the spirits of ending the show are in the background. Tom Metzger, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind. Great. Tom Metzger, author of Undercover Mormon. Thanks for listening from me and Majid Ali out there. Keep your minds open.